KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The Trump administration fired some federal workers and insulted more, but is the White House really making government more efficient? We call a woman who tried to reinvent government in the 1990s. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. House Republicans passed a budget plan without a vote to spare. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Some lawmakers approved more spending than they wanted. Others approved far more cuts than they wanted. So how do they fill in the details? Also, is 2 years old too young for a tablet? We have a report on screen time. And NASA plans two landings to look for water on the moon. It's Wednesday, February 26th, the birthday of Michael Bolton. How am I supposed to live without you? Happily, we don't have to. He's 72. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House says it is close to reaching a deal with Ukraine to share revenue from Ukraine's mineral resources. President Trump has been pressing for this arrangement as he discusses Russia's war in Ukraine. But Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky had initially balked because the deal does not include security guarantees for his country as it battles Russia's invasion. Zelensky is still pushing for the security guarantees, and he cautions the mineral deal is preliminary.
My question will be very direct: if the United States will stop support or not. Can we buy weapon? If it's not aid, can we buy weapon directly from the United States? Can we work with frozen assets for buying weapon, for example, than for full investment to a lot of things like minerals?
The Ukrainian president was heard on the BBC. In the U.S., a group of federal civil service workers is resigning from Elon Musk's government cost-cutting team. NPR's Bobby Allen reports 21 staff say they won't lend their technical expertise to, quote, dismantle critical public services.
21 civil service employees, mostly engineers and data scientists, have resigned. They used to work for U.S. Digital Service, but have since been folded into Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. In a mass resignation letter posted publicly, the former government workers say, quote, "We will not use our skills as technologists to compromise core government systems, jeopardize American sensitive data, or dismantle critical public services." The former federal government employees say soon after Musk began Doge, they started to be grilled about their work and political loyalty by people who wouldn't give their names wearing White House visitors badges. Musk has said the Doge team is focused on shrinking the size of government and combating waste and fraud. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Stocks opened higher this morning as dock workers on the East and Gulf Coasts approved a new six-year contract. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 120 points in early trading.
Approval of the dock workers contract comes as a relief to shippers who rely on ports along the East and Gulf Coast. It keeps cargo traffic flowing after a three-day work stoppage last fall. The contract raises pay for longshoremen by 62% over the next 6 years. It also sets some limits on port automation. Computer chip maker NVIDIA is set to report quarterly earnings after the market closes. The company's enjoyed tremendous growth, fueled by excitement over artificial intelligence. This will be NVIDIA's first report since the emergence of a Chinese AI company, DeepSeek, that relies on less expensive technology. Asian stocks were mixed overnight, up in Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Seoul, but slightly lower in Tokyo. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up about 130 points. The NASDAQ is up nearly 200 points. This is NPR. A federal judge has again warned the Trump administration to release billions of dollars in blocked foreign aid. It's for the U.S. Agency for International Development and the State Department. U.S. Judge Amir Ali had first told the administration to release the money about 2 weeks ago, but that hasn't happened. The new deadline is late tonight. It's not clear what'll happen if President Trump ignores the order. Israel's military says it struck targets in Syria, south of the capital, Damascus. The strikes came after Israel warned it would not allow Syria to move its soldiers into that region. NPR's Jackie Northam has more.
Israel's military says it struck targets in southern Syria, including command centers and several sites containing weapons, adding that the presence of military assets and forces south of Damascus constitutes what it says is a threat to Israel. The Israeli incursion comes after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over the weekend demanded the complete demilitarization of southern Syria and said that Israeli troops will remain inside the Syrian territory they seized shortly after the overthrow of longtime dictator Bashar al-Assad. Syria's new interim leader has said he will not allow Syrian territory to be used as a base for attacks against Israel. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
A global vault that stores seeds from around the world is getting more than 14,000 new samples. The Svalbard Global Seed Vault stores genetic samples of thousands of plant seeds from around the world. The vault is built above the Arctic Circle. I'm Korva Coleman. NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Coming up, lessons from the Clinton administration's efforts to shrink the federal government. But first, we cover a meeting of the officials aiming to cut the government now.
Today, the president holds his first meeting with his cabinet secretaries since taking office.
Yeah, also expected to show up, special government employee Elon Musk. He has been telling federal employees what to do, though the White House denies he's in charge of anything, and some cabinet secretaries have asserted their own authority over agencies.
NPR's Stephen Fowler is covering all this. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning.
So are all the people around the president on the same page?
Well, the White House says everyone is working as a team, but there's a few people claiming to be captain here, especially around this attempted restructuring of the federal government. Think of it this way, Steve. There's a Venn diagram of what Elon Musk says and does and posts, what the government has said in many court cases challenging Musk's decrees, and what federal agencies have actually done. And that Venn diagram has very little overlap right now.
Okay, and I guess an example of that would be this email. Over the weekend, it appeared over the weekend in everybody's mailboxes, like 2 million federal employees is what I mean, asking them to just explain what they're doing with their time or what they did last week. How much overlap do you see there in that Venn diagram?
This is a pretty great example where Elon Musk's preference is not government policy, is not what the government does in practice. Musk was repeatedly posting on the platform that he owns this threat of basically respond or lose your job. But he's not the boss of anyone within the federal government. And for the purposes of this request, neither is the agency that sent the email, the Office of Personnel Management. In fact, OPM previously noted in a privacy assessment, these government-wide emails are totally optional to respond to. And after some agencies told their people to ignore the request, other people said do it, OPM muddied the water even more with a memo that had more contradictory guidance about how to respond and or not respond and or maybe punish employees who didn't. Did you get all that?
No, I didn't, but please, go on, go on.
Well, so to that point, yesterday, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt wrapped it all up with this sort of walk back into some semblance of harmony.
So again, the agency heads will determine the best practices for their employees at their specific agencies. Again, this was an idea that Elon came up with. DOGE worked with OPM to actually implement the idea, and the secretaries are responsible for their specific workforce.
Now, Leavitt did say that 1 million workers responded by the deadline, but we just don't know what that means or what comes next for them there.
I appreciate hearing that Elon came up with the idea, according to the White House spokesperson there, because we hear then that a CEO did this thing that, as I understand it, business people will sometimes do. They'll send out a memo like that to everybody, but this is very different than the government is set up and the government works. So where does this go from here?
Well, this cabinet meeting is going to be worth watching because it's one of the first major public sources of tension between the Trump administration and the implementation of Musk's DOGE effort. But there's some other simmering conflicts in the background. Many of the actions that Musk and DOGE have taken are in court after running afoul of very particular and explicit set of rules and laws that govern the government.
Yeah.
And on the same day the White House acknowledged someone else is nominally running the U.S. DOGE service, nearly 24 people who worked for the precursor USDS say they're quitting instead of using their skills to, quote, compromise core government systems. Finally, as we await more details about a planned reduction in force of the remaining workforce, last night the Merit Systems Protection Board issued a stay on the firing of 6 probationary employees.
Wow. Hard to keep track of it all, but we'll do the best we can. NPR's Stephen Fowler, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Department of Government Efficiency isn't the first to try cutting the size of the federal government. During the Clinton administration in the 1990s, Vice President Al Gore called it reinventing government. Elaine Kmarc led the way on an initiative that wound up eliminating hundreds of thousands of federal positions. She's now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and is on the line. Thanks for being on the program. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Elaine, I want to start with these cuts that DOGE is making. There's a lot of support for making cuts to spending in the federal government from voters. Where the conflict arises is the approach. What is different or the same about what you did in the 1990s?
Well, what's the same is that we did set out to make government more efficient, and we set out to cut costs. And we did cut costs. We did cut personnel. We had savings. We cut 426,000 positions from the government. But it happened over a period of 7 years, and it happened after a look at every single cabinet department and then at the independent and regulatory agencies, where we had teams of people looking at the agencies and discussing with the agencies what could be cut and what should not be cut. So we had a goal, and the goal was to not just make the government cost less, but make it work better. And we focused a lot on efficiencies. We focused a lot on improving processes so that, for instance, at the FAA, they could buy computers faster. It used to take them 18 months to buy information technology. We got it down to 4 months, you know, things like that. So we had a dual purpose.
Was there as much blowback as we're seeing now to what you were doing?
No, not at all. In fact, someone asked me the other day, were you sued back in the 90s? And I said, no, we didn't have one lawsuit, okay, against us. We were not sued because, in fact, we stayed well within the law. You know, if there was a statute that was a problem, we went to the Congress and said, look, this statute is getting in the way of efficiency, and we asked Congress to change it. And most of the time they did. If it was a federal regulation, we started the process for removing the federal regulation and got it out of the way of impeding government efficiency. So we did not have nearly the blowback that's going on now.
Is there anything, though, about this approach that you think is working?
Not much. Okay. It's sowing chaos. It's, in fact, setting the government back on important jobs that it has to do. Let me give you an example. We're in tax season. 69% of Americans get tax refunds, big ones. The average is like $2,800. And guess what? With cutbacks at the IRS, I'm not sure people are going to get their refunds in time. Why would you be cutting tax collectors at the IRS in the middle of tax season? So this is really done in such a chaotic way and without regard for things that the government has to do.
How are certain things different, though? Then President Clinton did sign a bill allowing for buyouts for federal employees. We saw President Trump offer this resignation package, if you will. Why was that different from what DOGE suggested for federal workers?
Sure. Our buyout bill was passed by bipartisan congressional majorities. Mm-hmm. And so if you're a civil service worker and you are thinking of taking a buyout, you saw Congress just approve it. Congress approved the money. You knew you were going to get your money. Right now, the people who took the buyouts, they're in a peculiar position. There's about 100 lawsuits over this whole thing because of the way they just went at it with an axe, not a scalpel. And because of that, everything is up in the air, and who knows what might be repealed or changed in the course of the litigation.
Now, we saw 21 civil servants who just resigned from DOGE in protest saying, and I quote, "We will not use our skills as technologists to compromise core government systems, jeopardize American sensitive data, or dismantle critical public services." When you saw that, what did you think?
Well, first of all, those are not DOGE employees. Those are employees of the United States Digital Service, which was created under Obama, who then turned into DOGE. And what I think is one of the most worrying things about to everyone is the DOGE attempt to get into critical government databases like the Social Security database or the Treasury Payment Center. We never, in 7 years of working on efficiency in the government, needed to get into those databases. And getting into those databases to just read the data is one thing, mm-hmm. but it's unclear whether or not people have what they call write access to those databases. In other words, they're going to actually change the algorithms that govern the bases. And that's very frightening if you're receiving Social Security or you're looking for a tax refund or whatever.
Elaine K. Mark, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
A new report says kids are logging on earlier than ever. Here's Katie Riddle.
One of the most surprising statistics from this report, 40% of children have their own tablet by the time they are 2 years old. It sounds bananas, but ask any parent of young children and you can see how this habit gets started.
As a parent, a car ride, an airplane ride, a busy time at home where you don't have the support and you aren't giving your kids enough attention, we rely on technology.
Sunny Thadani has 3 young children. He lives in New York City and works in tech. He has resisted giving his kids their own devices, but still, he says, sometimes in his busy household of 2 working parents, screen distractions are handy.
Do we rely on it as parents too much? And is that our first sort of answer? And I think for me, sometimes it is. And it's one of the challenges I have as just an individual and a father, doing all the things that I want to accomplish personally and professionally and as a parent.
It's clear that parents are deeply conflicted about this digitalization of childhood.
Jim Steyer is the CEO of Common Sense Media. The organization makes recommendations for parents on safe media choices for kids. They put out this report. These are treacherous waters for parents to navigate. But Steyer says there are a few key strategies. The first one.
Delay, delay, delay. Whether it's a cell phone, a tablet, or whatever.
There's no getting around it. Kids are going to be watching screens. But Steyer says the longer parents can hold out on giving them their own device, the better. The second tip, not all content is created equally. Know what your kids are watching.
Young children now average 2.5 hours of daily screen time, predominantly watching short-form video content rather than educational programming like Sesame Street.
Screen time is an overwhelming conundrum, says Steyer. But the worst thing parents can do is throw up their hands and ignore the problem. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency has eliminated the jobs of thousands of government employees and left many more uncertain about their positions. We'll talk with Harvard Professor of Public Policy Elizabeth Linos about what that means for federal workers and the rest of us who depend on government services. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldil. Amid the agricultural and manufacturing towns of southeastern Iowa, Mahaska Health is a small hospital, and it's worried about the Trump administration's funding cuts. Despite its remote location, its patients can access cancer specialists from around the state, and losing federal funds could affect that, as NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
What Kathy Evenhouse loves about rural life is how people care for one another, driving a neighbor to doctor's appointments, for example.
We set up a team of people who drive her to Des Moines or to wherever she needs to go. I mean, that's what small communities do for each other.
Evenhouse herself is 73 and has had multiple cancers near her spine, in her thyroid, blood, and left leg. Most of her doctors work in Iowa City, an hour and a half's drive from Pella, where she lives.
For me to go to Iowa City, my whole day is gone.
Mahaska Health, on the other hand, is a 25-bed hospital that's relatively close to home. And from there, Evenhouse can remotely access doctors from around the state to help her decide her care. Recently, for example, a team determined surgery on her back could be performed locally.
It's really an advantage for me because I can see the experts. I can get their input.
Dr. Daniel Kohlmorgen is Mahaska Health's surgical oncologist. He moved to rural Oskaloosa 2 years ago, hoping to fight Iowa's cancer rate, which is the second highest in the country and rising. To do that, Kohlmorgen uses databases funded by the National Cancer Institute that track local disease statistics. Those allow him to know which hotspots to target outreach about screenings, for example. Kohlmorgen also worked to expand the Iowa Cancer Affiliate Network, teams of disease experts who help him with Evenhouse's care, for example.
We review complex cancer cases at our small hospital on a regular basis, but we can zoom in pathologists and specialty surgeons and others from around the state, and we're starting to try to build that so we can bring that care to the patients locally.
Various Trump administration cuts, from contract freezes to a $4 billion cut to research institutions, could hamper or shut down such efforts. And Kohlmorgen says that would mean Iowans would fall further behind on cancer.
The reason we have more stage 3 and 4 cancers in rural Iowa is oftentimes due to lack of screening, lack of awareness, lack of transportation. And when we don't have these funds to help reach out to those patients, I think we'll see the numbers continue their upward trend.
Mark Burkhard directs the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Iowa. He had been hoping to expand use of centralized cancer specialists to patients in rural hospitals around the state.
That process of advancing that network to deliver quality care will be interrupted if we need to focus on our immediate budgetary needs.
That poses a conflict for Kathy Evenhouse. She voted for President Trump and supports, in concept, federal spending cuts. But now she sees the downsides.
It is hurtful just to the good things to cut it off, but I do think that we had to do something. I think it could have been done with a scalpel instead of a hatchet.
She says the cuts ought to be, like surgery, more precise. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
If astronauts ever want to spend more than a few days on the moon, they're going to need to find some local resources, like water. Scientists are pretty sure there's water up there somewhere, they just don't know exactly where, and so two lunar missions will try to start answering that question. Joe Palca tells us a four-day launch window for those missions opens tonight.
If all goes according to plan, the first of the probes to reach the moon will be a lander built by the company Intuitive Machines. The trip to the moon is pretty short.
It takes about 3 to 4 days, depending on where we launch in that launch window.
Tim Crane is chief technology officer at Intuitive Machines.
We arrive at the moon, we orbit the moon for 2 to 3 days, basically to let the sun move over the landing site.
The lander's solar panels need sun to generate power.
And it takes about 15 minutes once we light the engine to come down and to do a soft touch landing.
The landing site is near the lunar south pole. This is Intuitive Machines' second attempt to land on the moon. They tried a year ago, but the probe kind of tipped over after landing.
We definitely contacted the ground harder than we expected. And, you know, in the space game, usually if things don't work out exactly the way you planned, they don't work out at all.
But even though it tipped over, they got a good amount of data before it ran out of power. So Crane is pretty pleased with the first try. The new lander carries quite an array of tools. One is a drill made by NASA that will look for water under the lunar surface. There's also a small rover that will be used to test a 4G local communications network built by Nokia.
So now you've got a drill drilling, you've got a rover roving, and then we've got a hopper.
The hopper is basically a rocket pack that can bop around the landing site looking inside of craters that have never been explored. The same rocket launching the Intuitive Machines lander on its mission is also carrying a spacecraft called Lunar Trailblazer. That dishwasher-sized probe is intended to go into orbit around the moon.
The focus of the mission is trying to understand the abundance and the form and distribution of lunar water and the lunar water cycle.
Angela Dapremont is from the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory. She says, yes, scientists are pretty sure there is water on the moon. They're just not sure what form it's in.
Is it molecular water? Is it water ice?
Knowing that makes a big difference when it comes to making use of the water. Lunar Trailblazer is one of NASA's new class of small, innovative exploratory spacecraft. One of the intriguing aspects of the mission is that it's being operated in part by students in what basically is a small conference room. Lee Bennett is an engineer at Caltech and Lunar Trailblazer's mission manager. He says most deep space probes are run out of NASA's nearby Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
But for a lot of these smaller spacecraft is now moving to college campuses.
Lunar Trailblazer separates from the Intuitive Machines lander shortly after takeoff. Because its engine is not very powerful, it will take the smaller probe several months to reach the moon and go into the orbit it needs for its scientific mission. For NPR News, I'm Joe Palca.
This is NPR News.
Quick, what's 3 plus 9? Oh, that's too easy for you? Okay, what about 3 minus the root of 2,950? Well, even if you can solve that problem, you probably can't do it as fast as 14-year-old world record holder Arun Shukla. For him, numbers are a game.
I love playing with numbers.
I'm Ari Shapiro. We meet the human calculator on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly.
The U.S. and Ukraine have agreed on the framework of an economic deal as part of the Trump administration's effort to negotiate an end to Russia's war in Ukraine. That's according to Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, speaking earlier today in Kyiv. He cautions the extent of U.S. security guarantees is still unclear. Elon Musk is expected to attend President Trump's first cabinet meeting of his second term today. Musk is overseeing Trump's effort to downsize the federal government. So far, thousands of federal employees have lost their jobs, including another 1,400 at the Department of Veterans Affairs, as NPR's Quill Lawrence reports.
Job cuts at the VA now total around 2,500, which the Veterans of Foreign Wars, VFW, called indiscriminate firings. Nearly a third of VA staffers are veterans themselves, and several of those let go say they received excellent reviews before sudden termination for poor performance. Veterans fired from the VA suicide crisis hotline told NPR they were let go and suddenly rehired days later. Senators on the Veterans Affairs Committee from both parties say they have asked but not received explanations from VA about the cuts. In a statement, VA said none of the jobs cut are mission critical and that VA continues to hire for more than 300,000 critical posts that are exempt from the federal hiring freeze.
This is NPR News. Later today, a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket is scheduled to lift off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. It will carry two probes that are part of a search for water on the moon. As Joe Palca reports, one of the probes will drill into the lunar surface, while the other will make observations from lunar orbit.
The lander is made by Intuitive Machines. Its landing site is near the moon's south pole, a spot scientists have detected water deposits. It carries a drill built by NASA that will cut 3 feet through the rocks that make up the lunar surface, hoping to find subsurface water deposits. The drill also has a spectrometer that will analyze any gases released by the drilling. The orbiter is called Lunar Trailblazer. The dishwasher-sized spacecraft has instruments designed to pinpoint the location of water deposits and determine whether the water is in the form of ice or possibly water molecules bound to rocks. Knowing the form the water is in will be crucial if future visitors want to make use of it. For NPR News, I'm Joe Palca.
A jury in California is awarding more than $7 million to an Arizona woman who suffered a spine injury when she fell while exiting a ride at Universal Studios in Hollywood 3 years ago. The woman is 74. She fell while stepping from a moving walkway at the Harry Potter and the Forbidden Journey ride with her grandson. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from USPS, USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation, collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. House Republicans last night began a long process of trying to reshape the government to their liking.
Republicans passed a budget plan without a single vote to spare. Speaker Mike Johnson had a problem with some lawmakers reluctant to sign on until they switched at the last moment.
We have a lot of hard work ahead of us. But well, we are going to deliver the America First agenda. We're going to deliver all of it, not just parts of it. And this is the first step in that process.
Now, the spending cuts in this budget blueprint are different from the ones announced so far by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. For one thing, the cuts are big. For another, they would be legal, assuming Congress follows through on the rest of a very long process.
NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales has covered that process in the past, is covering it once again. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so I'm thinking this through. Democrats all voted no, said they were just gross spending cuts. Some right. Republicans were worried about this, also worried about too much borrowing, they said, still. So what's the final package say?
So lots of sweeping changes if Republicans can get to the finish line with the final product. But the framework that was passed last night spells out plans for new immigration, defense, energy, and tax policy. And there's a lot of big numbers here. For one, it calls for $4.5 trillion in tax cuts. That's tied to an extension of the 2017 Trump tax cuts that are expiring at the end of the year. And then campaign promises are also included in this plan that Trump made about eliminating taxes on tips. It also calls for $2 trillion in cuts to federal spending that would dramatically reshape the federal budget, numbers that help fuel a lot of internal disagreement for the party.
Yeah, and I guess we should mention that's over the course of a decade, but they're still pretty big on an annual basis. It sounds like the party's right wing ultimately caused more trouble than the more moderate wing.
Exactly. We saw a lot of those that were worried about the spending as holdouts at the beginning of the day. That includes Representative Warren Davidson of Ohio, Victoria Spartz of Indiana, and Tim Burchett of Tennessee. But they all flipped in the end. The party was facing a very tight margin and could only lose perhaps one member. That was it. So it set up this chaotic vote that was on. It was off and back on again in a matter of 10 minutes. But members such as Burchett switched to a yes after a phone call with Trump. So in the end, Kentucky Republican Thomas Massie was the only no. He's a loyal fiscal hawk who was opposed to the trillions in new spending. The spending cut plans kept the other fiscal hawks in line, but there's still remaining concerns about the potential to cuts to Medicaid, which could impact more than 70 million Americans who depend on this health insurance, and that's something Republicans will have to iron out in the coming weeks.
Claudia, I just want to underline the process here. As Layla mentioned, whatever Elon Musk has done is being challenged in court. In many cases, seems to be illegal. As we've reported, has hardly saved any money in the larger sense. But this is like real numbers through a legal process. So what is, comes next in that process?
This kicks off a process. It's known as reconciliation. It's an obscure budget tool, but it lets Republicans overcome a Democratic filibuster in the Senate. Next steps involve actually writing the text for the budget that will become law. Last night was supposed to be the easy part, but it took them weeks to get here. So we'll see if they can seal the deal in the coming weeks.
Claudia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
NPR's Claudia Grisales.
President Trump says his policies will usher in a new age of American manufacturing. But in one New England town that voted for him, Trump's hostility to offshore wind has tanked a company's plans to build a new factory. From our member station, The Public's Radio, Ben Burke has the story.
Lloyd Mendes lives in the Brayton Point neighborhood of Somerset, Massachusetts, a place where pristine nature rubs up against big industry.
We have osprey here. We have red-winged blackbirds. Oh, beautiful place there.
Even though it's next to a power plant.
Here, hold it. Let me get my coat on.
Mendes takes me hiking along the beach in the salt marsh near the old Brayton Point power plant. The plant was the biggest employer in town before it closed in 2017. Most of it's been demolished, leaving behind 200 dusty acres of land with deep water access. This real estate eventually caught the attention of an Italian company that manufactures undersea cables for offshore wind farms. Mendes spent many late nights in town meetings vetting a proposal the company put forward.
They were going to buy 47 acres and they were going to put a huge factory there. It was a great deal. I totally supported it.
The Prysmian Group's cable factory would have created at least 150 new manufacturing jobs across the water from Fall River, a city of 95,000 people that used to be filled with textile and apparel factories. From the top floor of Fall River's government center, Mayor Paul Coogan has a view of the waterfront where Prysmian was planning its factory.
It's sad. I can see it from here, and I can only imagine the number of people that went to work there from Fall River.
The disappointment comes with a twist of irony. President Trump won Fall River this November, It was the first time in 100 years the city voted Republican. Then, just a few weeks later, Prysmian canceled its plans to build the cable factory. The company declined an interview request and said in a prepared statement that Prysmian is aligning manufacturing capacity with changing market demands. Politicians who represent the area, like Democratic Congressman Jake Auchincloss, blame Trump for Prysmian's sudden shift in outlook, even though the company didn't mention the president.
Prysmian won't do it, but there's no question that Trump's moratorium had a decisive impact on Prysmian's decision.
Trump strongly favors fossil fuels like oil and natural gas. On his first day in office, he issued an executive order banning future leases of federal waters to offshore wind developers. Elizabeth Wilson teaches environmental studies at Dartmouth College. She says international manufacturers won't build American factories unless they can count on lots of domestic offshore wind projects getting built. Wilson says Trump is not only refusing to approve new projects, he's threatening wind farms that were already under development.
That level of political uncertainty does not provide a stable investment climate for companies to build significantly large manufacturing facilities.
The economic impact could extend far beyond New England. Costa Samaras is a former advisor in the Biden administration who now researches energy innovation at Carnegie Mellon University. He says there are plans to build or expand at least 23 American factories to manufacture offshore wind components.
And a lot of that is at risk.
Samara says many of these 23 factories represent huge investments in cities that lost their founding industries.
When we talk about billions of dollars or number of factories, we got to remember that these are people, people's jobs, people's livelihoods, people's communities.
In Somerset, Prysmian's factory could have pulled the town out of a hard financial situation. Somerset lost half its property tax revenue when the power plant closed. And with offshore wind development paused under President Trump, it's unclear when the town will recover. For NPR News in Fall River, I'm Ben Burke.
This is NPR News.
After losing U.S. funding, 9 Ethiopian clinics for victims of torture have closed. What happens to their patients? Next time on Here and Now.
News stories do not wait to unfold. They just happen. And when they do, no matter where you are, NPR helps you stay connected. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org on your phone.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. The Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle has a new animal that's a rock star. She's a newborn sloth bear cub. Now, people associate the sloth with sloth, which is so unfair. They're kind of cute and fun to hang around with. This baby is healthy and her eyes have opened and she has a cool name. She is Bowie because she shares a birthday January 8th with the late music star. She's a young American. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The duration of fishing season depends on the fish. Some of them you can fish for all year. Others you can try for only in certain months, or even a single day. In Northeast Michigan this year, the season for one particular fish lasted minutes. Teresa Holmsey of our member station WCMU watched the spearing of a dinosaur fish.
Ice shanties dot the horizon as the sun rises over a frozen lake in northern Michigan. It's 8 a.m. on a Saturday and only 4 degrees out, but hundreds of people have gathered here, all because of the elusive prehistoric lake sturgeon. They're one of the largest fish in North America and have a shark-like tail and a bony-plated covering.
They call them living fossils because they first appeared in the fossil record 130 or so million years ago. And so that's the time when dinosaurs still would have been walking the earth.
That's Doug Larson, a sturgeon researcher from Michigan State University. He's with a crowd of spectators who are clamoring to catch a glimpse of the fish. Lake sturgeon are not considered endangered, but they're listed as a threatened species in Michigan. For the last 25 years, the state has run a limited sturgeon season on this lake. Only 6 to 7 fish can be caught this year, but nearly 800 people have shown up for the chance. There wasn't a season last year because a record-breaking warm winter canceled the event.
Having the fishing season, the fishing contest, way better. It's fabulous. We're excited.
Jay Wodersky is with Sturgeon for Tomorrow, the local nonprofit that supports sturgeon conservation. He says the limited season keeps the cultural relevance of the lake sturgeon alive, and the fish population has more than doubled in the last 25 years.
Well, obviously, we're bringing awareness to it through the whole country. It's such a well-regulated season, and we're restricted to 1.2% of the total population in this lake.
This year, there's barely any time for anticipation to set in. In a quick procession, a series of text messages goes out to all the participants when a fish is caught. And only 17 minutes after the 8 a.m. start time,
the Black Lake sturgeon season is over.
The winning spearfishers bring their prized fish up to state officials, who take the sturgeon's measurements and scan them for tags.
And whoever owns that fish can take it home. 18 pounds.
The crowd of onlookers parts for the lucky 7 fishermen and women who rise to celebrity status as they haul their fish around and pose for pictures.
It's like Taylor Swift show.
Everybody's just... Where's Kelsey?
I seen 4. So we kind of knew we were in a good spot.
Debbie Lalone speared the first fish of the season, and she's all smiles. It's her first time catching a sturgeon.
I was shaking. I was nervous, but it was exciting.
The largest fish is 5'3" and weighs nearly 80 pounds. A tag indicates this female sturgeon was caught 14 years ago during routine monitoring. There's no good way to know how old she is, but Larson, the MSU researcher, says she may be more than a century old.
In the 24 years that we've been doing this, we've caught her one time, so this is a very elusive fish for us, but not for the spear.
And all of the dinosaur fish were caught in 17 minutes, a record-breaking time. For NPR News, I'm Teresa Holmsey in Sheboygan, Michigan.
First time I ever heard Taylor Swift compared to a sturgeon. But anyway, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
Thank you.
Why are consumers turning so sour on the economy?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. The Name Your Price tool provides a range of coverage options. Progressive.com. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm David Brancaccio in New York. First, the U.S. and Ukraine have agreed to a draft deal to give U.S. access to Ukraine's rare earth minerals. This is a key demand of the Trump administration, and Ukrainian officials may have believed the concession was necessary to maintain U.S. support in the war against Russia. Russia invaded Ukraine 3 years ago this week, yet President Trump had said that Ukraine, quote, never should have started it. Marketplace's Nova Safo has more on the emerging minerals deal.
Yeah, the details of it are still fuzzy, David, but the broad outlines of this tentative deal apparently include a reserve fund paid for by proceeds from the mining of rare earth minerals in Ukraine, and the U.S. would have a joint ownership stake of some sort. President Trump had previously demanded $500 billion in mineral revenues from Ukraine as payback for past support, although the U.S. has not spent anywhere near that much in military aid for Ukraine. In any case, that's apparently not in the deal. Meanwhile, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky had been seeking security guarantees and ongoing military support. We don't know if that's included in this tentative deal either. What we do know is the two leaders are likely to meet soon for more talks. Trump said yesterday that Zelensky wants to come to the White House to sign this deal, maybe as soon as Friday, David.
Friday. All right. And how much of these valuable minerals is Ukraine thought to have?
Well, by its own accounting, Ukraine says it has about 21 so-called critical raw minerals, which are necessary for green energy development, electric vehicles, and battery power. Now, we're talking about minerals like lithium and graphite. It has about 3% of the world's lithium reserves. So Zelensky had floated the mineral reserves as an area of investment in the past, but he balked at the initial U.S. proposal and said generations of Ukrainians would be indebted to the U.S. Now there's a deal that could provide an economic stake for the U.S. and Ukraine's welfare, and that is apparently something Ukraine favors in the long run.
Okay, thank you. New surveys show a lot of people have gotten quite nervous about the economy. Yesterday, the business group, the Conference Board, reported the biggest monthly decline in consumer confidence since 2021. February was the third straight month that confidence fell. Everything from future business conditions, worry about incomes and jobs, to family plans for spending. Separately, last week, the University of Michigan survey also reported a sharp decline in the optimism of consumers, along with a sharp increase in inflation expectations. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
There have been signs of rising consumer agita for months, says Tuan Nguyen at consulting firm RSM. But the latest decline in sentiment?
It was quite a surprise. We did not anticipate it would be this significant.
And what's driving it?
Consumers are increasingly concerned about inflation. We are seeing the impact of higher food prices, particularly egg prices, rising gasoline costs, and talk around higher tariffs.
Mostly, threatened tariffs haven't happened yet. Still, says economist Elizabeth Renter at NerdWallet,
a big part of what's going on is uncertainty. It's in a lot of headlines right now. Economists are saying they're uncertain about things. We see it in the Fed meeting minutes.
Economist Robert Frick at Navy Federal Credit Union calls it
a sense of foreboding with tariffs and with layoffs
of federal workers, which the Trump administration has started to implement.
You could lose 10% of the federal workforce, 300,000 people. You could lose 500,000 federal contractors.
We don't know how all this tariff raising and job cutting is going to turn out, but the uncertainty is bumming consumers out, meaning they're likely to pull back their spending, right? Frick says probably not.
Consumer confidence, consumer sentiment have very little bearing on how people actually spend.
He says as long as consumers' incomes are going up and beating inflation, they're likely to keep spending. Meanwhile, fears of tariff-driven inflation might actually encourage more spending, says Elizabeth Renter.
If I had plans to purchase a vehicle in 2025, but I think vehicle prices are going to climb significantly over the next year, I might accelerate that, purchase it right now.
And Renter warns this accelerated spending to get a jump on tariffs could drive some consumers to take on more high-interest debt than they can afford. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Markets, the Dow is up 223 points, 0.5%. The S&P is up 0.8%. The NASDAQ is up 1% now. Market players are waiting for the big AI stocks quarterly profit report later today. That's chipmaker NVIDIA. That stock is up more than 4% now.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com. And by the Marketplace newsletter. No jargon, no hype, just smart takes on the economy. Marketplace.org/subscribe.
According to the president, the U.S. is planning to launch a new green card for wealthy people who want to immigrate and become U.S. citizens. It's to be called a gold card. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that.
President Trump unveiled the gold card idea while speaking to reporters in the Oval Office. He says the cards would give wealthy people the right to live and work in the U.S.
We're going to be selling a gold card. You have a green card. This is a gold card. We're going to be putting a price on that card of about $5 million, and that's going to give you green card privileges plus. It's going to be a route to citizenship.
Trump said the U.S. will start selling the cards in about 2 weeks. Asked if Russian oligarchs would be eligible for gold cards, Trump said possibly, adding he knows some Russian oligarchs that are, quote, very nice people. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick was standing next to Trump. He said immigrants applying for the new gold cards would be vetted, and the card would replace the current EB-5 program for wealthy immigrant investors. It gives green cards to foreigners who invest a certain amount of money in a U.S. business. But Congress is in charge of immigration law, and the president doesn't have the authority to ignore or override the law. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
And a satellite company owned by the unofficial czar of federal staff cuts, that's Elon Musk, is on a possible fast track to take over a large federal contract to modernize America's air traffic communication system. The Associated Press is reporting that equipment from Musk's Starlink has been installed in Federal Aviation Administration facilities as a prelude to a possible switch to what has been a $2 billion Verizon contract. The AP got this info from government employees and contractors. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
I'm doing Take On Me now. Alright. I really like this song. It sounds good. Mining away. I don't know what to mine. I'll mine this anyway. In this Minecraft day. So beautiful. I'm further than. What's that I found? Mine died.